life to choose. Nightmare made of hash dreams, got the devil in my shoes. Tell me, what have I done wrong? And nothing go right with me, must be I've been smoking too long. Well, when I'm smoking, put my worries on a shelf. Don't think about nothing, try not to see myself. Tell me, what have I done wrong? And nothing go right with me, must be I've been smoking too long. Well, in this blues I'm singing, there's a lesson to be learned. Don't go around smoking unless you wanna get burned. Tell me, what have I done wrong? Ain't nothing go right with me, must be I've been smoking too. Ain't nothing go right with me, must be I've been smoking too. Everything gone wrong with me, must be I've been smoking too long.
Oh, yes, Been Smoking Too Long, and written by Robin Frederick, my guest on my show this evening. Welcome back, Robin.
I'm here.
Oh, great.
Well, he changed a line in that song.
Ah.
And the line he sings is, got no other life to choose. He replaced the line, the original line was Got the Marijuana Blues.
Ah.
It was just part of the list of things that are going wrong. And he changed it, and I think it's telling that he did.
Hmm.
What he changed it to, because it's that kind of fatalism that it pervades so many of his songs. Even that early on, I think the first song he ever wrote, which he would have written right at that time, is a song called Leaving Me Behind, and it's also on the Family Tree album. And
okay.
And in it he says, he talks about other people having a future, and he says, but I think they're leaving me behind. In the opening verse is, the tramp moves on to the end of the street. I listen to the echo of his hobnail feet. For him, there's a future to find, but I think he's leaving me behind. And so many of his songs are about being caught, being stuck. You know, in Riverman, he says, there's a ban on feeling free. Everyone's coming, oh, how they come and go, but not me. You know, I have a ban on feeling free. Over and over, day is done. It's so sad when things are over and you can't win and you didn't get there. It's constant from even these early songs when he's only 18, all the way up until the last songs he wrote, in which he's talking about, you know, harvest breed, you're falling and this is the end, or you can take the road that'll see you through, that takes you to the stars, but I'll take the road that'll see me through. There's that constant thread of fatalism, loss, being left, abandonment, and it starts this early, it starts right away.
Interesting at that time. Obviously since then you've done some research into his family, and do you see any clues there?
I don't. I think there's one obvious place to look, and that is when British families sent their young boys away to boarding school at age 8 or 9. And some boys, I think, handled that very well. I mean, as well as you can. And sometimes some boys had the personality that was okay for them. And I understand why people did it culturally. And you can't really blame the parents who did it, because this was accepted. It was what you did. It was what his father did and his grandfather did. So, of course, Nick would go off to boarding school. I think Nick was very, very attached to his mother, and she was quite a remarkable songwriter in her own right. And perhaps he was just the kind of child that, you know, maybe should have remained at home on a few years longer. And I think that sense of abandonment may have come back later on to haunt some of his songs. His mother, there's a wonderful song of hers in the DVD of a Skin Too Few, it's called. It's a documentary about Nick. It's just wonderful, and it's included in the box set, the Fruit Tree box set that was released a couple years ago. And so if you have that box set, you can see it. And I'm sure they'll release it independently one of these days. And in it, Gabrielle plays a song of her mother's on cassette. This family recorded everything they did. They had tape recorders, I mean, from a very young age. And tape recorders were very scarce items when our generation was growing up. And his father was really into taping, and they were all into music. His father also was played piano and composed. And so they have these wonderful songs by his mother. And this particular one is played in that movie and in that documentary. And in it, she uses language and chord progressions and melodies very similar in some ways, although she's a throwback. I mean, she's within the context of Noel Coward and British Music Hall.
Right.
Still, there's unquestionably a musical influence and a lyric influence and probably a deep emotional influence on him. I've got a lyric. I can read you a little of the lyric for A Skin Too Few.
Oh, yes.
She wrote, "An acorn carries an oak tree, sleeping but for a little while. Winter lies in the arm of spring, as a mother carries her child and never knows how wild the wind blows. A thought carries a universe. A seed carries a field of grain. Love lies in the arms of change, as a joy carries a pain, and no one knows how wild the wind blows." There's so much of this song in a song of Nick's like Fruit Tree, where she says, when I looked at this lyric a little deeply, because I actually played this song recently over at a tribute concert in the UK.
Oh, we're going to talk about that, yeah.
Oh, definitely, yes. And when I looked at this, what I saw was the line, "Winter lies in the arm of spring, as a mother carries her child." And I looked at this, and suddenly I thought, wait a minute, it's winter who lies in the arms of spring, as a child lies in its mother's arms. Winter is the child. And what an odd thing to say. And then it's usually the other way around. The parent is the older, is the winter, and the child is spring. In this case, winter is the child. What a strange thing to say. And then if you look at Nick's song, Fruit Tree, you see forgotten, deep in the arms of an everlasting light night, you'll find that darkness can give the brightest light. That same kind of backwards thinking that makes you see things in a way that you haven't seen them before. His mother had that ability, and she wrote like that. And I think that's a tremendous... I do hope that there will be, at some point, I do hope there will be her songs will be released. She was a fine singer and a piano player. They're of their time. But the minute you start looking closer at her, you begin to realize what a tremendous talent she was, and certainly an influence on him.
Well, do you think they were competitive?
I don't... You know, Gabrielle said a wonderful thing about this. She said, like any young man, Nick would have been appalled if anyone had thought he was influenced by his mother. So I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. He'll never admit it. Yeah.
No, never. But it's certainly underneath the surface. It's certainly there. And when you look at his chords and her chords, her chord progressions, you do see similarities there also. Tribute concert.
Yes.
The tribute concert in Birmingham, that was a wonderful experience and a wonderful evening. I do hope that sometime people will be able to hear a recording of that. I have no idea. I really don't know if there's any plans to release it. I heard a little rumor that there might be some plans to release it on CD. It was a wonderful night. It was the songs of Nick Drake being performed by Martha Wainwright, Beth Orton, Harper Simon, who's Paul Simon's son, Robin Hitchcock, and Graham Coxon, and Camille O'Sullivan. I'm sorry if I've... oh, and Vashti Bunyan.
Oh, the famous Vashti Bunyan.
She was magnificent. She sang one of Nick's mother's songs. And she was brilliant. Everybody was... I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I was just so thrilled to be a part of it. Beth Orton and Martha Wainwright are both... and Camille O'Sullivan. Absolutely stunning singers. And when you hear them not singing their own songs, you hear them singing Nick's songs. I think, I'm not quite sure why, but for some reason, it was even more apparent what remarkable singers they both are. They did a, Beth Orton did Time Has Told Me, a beautiful version of that. And the entire evening, it was just one magnificent performance after the next. It was truly a very special evening. I came out and talked a little bit about what a unique and a song River Man is, and the kinds of things Nick was doing to create the feeling, how he evokes the sense of the river by putting the song in a very unusual time signature. It's in 5/4 time, which nobody writes in pop music in 5/4 time. And it gives a sense of a forward-flowing river, and how he creates forward momentum by starting the melody in the middle of the beats, and then how he uses all of that to create the sense in the listener of motion, even as he says in the song, "But I have a ban on feeling free. I can't move. All of you can move ahead and find your life and get on with it, but I can't." And it's a magnificent example of how Nick makes us feel safe. He expresses beauty at the same time as he is expressing despair. That's what makes him so unusual. So I played a little bit of it just to demonstrate. And then about two or three songs later, Camille O'Sullivan came out on stage with the full orchestra and sang a magnificent version of River Man. It was, she had the audience hanging on her every note. She's a tremendous singer and actor, and she did a beautiful job with it. So a very, altogether, just a very special evening. Joe Boyd introduced it and closed it, and then afterwards he and Robert Kirby and I did about 45 minutes where we just talked about Nick's songs and recording with him and working with him, knowing him.
From that, yeah, I mean, what a guy Joe Boyd was. I'm just so, I mean, I've always loved him, just what he put together. I mean, what an everlasting set of music of people he put together, and very different people managed to get it out there.
He is a producer in the sense of the word, of producing from people what it is they want to get out there. He facilitates, he makes it possible by putting people together and connecting, making connections. And he's doing it to this day. He produced the Birmingham tribute concert. He put that together. He was the one who said to Vashti Bunyan, "I want you to sing one of Nick's mother's songs." And, you know, to say to Beth, "I want you to do Time Has Told Me." And at the end of the show, the very last song, the encore that we all did, we sang a song, one of Nick's final songs, called Voice from the Mountain. And this was Joe's choice to make that the encore. And I think it was absolutely brilliant, because as we sang it, we realized that it was Nick's voice that was coming from the mountain. There's a lot of emotion in it even now. My job was to get through the song without crying, and which I managed to do that night, but I'm not doing now. It was a remarkable moment to sing that song back to Nick after all these years, and sing it back and say, sometimes there's a bridge across time.
Mm.
I felt it when I heard him sing Been Smoking Too Long. After all those years, I heard his voice singing my song back to me,
mm-hmm.
and I had never heard him sing it in life, but I heard him sing it long after. And suddenly, all of that time vanished.
Mm.
It was gone, and as if it was yesterday, and he was there, and he was singing it, this bridge across time. And I felt it again that night in Birmingham as we sang that song, Voice from the Mountain, and it and all of us, Beth Orton and Martha and Harper and everyone, sang it back to Nick, and in a sense, I think, closed a circle, you know, of emotion. That was a very powerful moment.
Wow. Oh, that's beautiful. You know, that's it. He had such... his music was just very difficult to... pin down what style it was. That's what always got me when I, you know, first heard him in 68 or whatever. It was just such a original. The originality of it was so obvious to me anyway.
Yes. And I think in many ways we're only catching up with him now.
Mm.
As a songwriter, I'm fascinated by how songs are made and how melodies work, how they create emotion, how they evoke, you know, such a strong reaction from us. And Nick really opened many doors for me into how songs work. And it didn't happen until really about 10 years ago when I started to look more closely. I've had his albums ever since they came out. And I've enjoyed them, and I don't think I ever questioned, you know, what the style was. They were just my friend Nick and his albums,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't get anybody interested in them in Los Angeles. Nobody. I would play them for people, and they'd go, "Oh, what's that?" You know. And so I just finally stopped playing them for people.
Right.
But about 10 years ago, I went back. I felt really strongly drawn back to his music. And I began one night, I wanted to learn the song Place to Be, which is a very simple sounding song on the Pink Moon album.
Mm.
And I thought, oh, well, I'll just learn this song. I don't remember why I wanted to learn it, but I did. And I started to do what I do, which is play along and sing along with the record to learn the song.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how hard I tried, I could not anticipate where he was going to start singing the next line.
Huh.
I'd come in too early or I'd come in too late. I just couldn't, and it sounds like such a simple song. And it was driving me crazy. So finally I said, I have to figure this out because that's what I do. As a songwriter, that's what I do. So I sat there and I began counting along to him. You know, one, it's in 3/4 time. And I'd be counting along, and he, by golly, he would come in, you know, on beat. If I'm counting in 6/8 time, he'd come in on beat 4.
Mm.
Beat 4 is in the middle of nowhere, and nobody starts singing on beat 4. And he did. And I thought, well, this is a revelation. What's he doing? And then I began looking at all the songs, and he was doing it on every single song right from the beginning, right from the very first time he's told me he was doing it. Starting on the third beat of the bar, or the fourth beat of 6 beats, or just in the middle of nowhere, or the fourth beat of 5. It just, you don't even have to know music speak to just count to 4, and I'm telling you, Nick will surprise you. And you know what's funny? Back then, nobody did that.
Mm.
Nobody. Now, we all do it. It's the hallmark of singer-songwriters like Tori Amos. Just about any singer-songwriter you can think of, John Mayer, we all do it. We start on unusual and unexpected beats. We have phrases that are longer than you expect or shorter.
Mm.
Nick was doing all of those things in 1969 when he was 20 years old.
Wow.
It's the genius of that. And that's just one of the things he was doing besides the remarkable chords he was playing on guitar, which he had to detune, make up tunings to do them.
Wow.
And we're only catching up with that now. It's just an astonishing musical genius on the level of the caliber of Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, who invented much of the chord changes, lots of things that have influenced songwriters to this day.
Mm-hmm.
Nick, I think because he did it so quietly and because he didn't have hit songs, no one noticed what he was doing. I'm so glad that people have finally caught up with him.
Yes.
You know, that's my rant on Nick Drake. Sorry about that.
No, we are very like Mike. You know, I've always loved him, and when the vinyl box set came out in, I suppose, the 80s, I got that, you know. And,
yes.
And I've always wondered why on earth he isn't popular. He's such an amazing creative genius. And so I'm glad it took a VW advert to make him famous.
I am, too. I'm very happy with the VW commercial. And I think that the tremendously revealing lyrics, which we do now, we're much more concessional now in our lyric writing. And really, I mean, that revolution was begun largely by Joni Mitchell on the Blue album, was when that started. And people said, don't put that out. You can't put that out. That's too personal. And we now, we now expect our songwriters to reveal their most intimate secrets in their songs. And Nick was doing it back then, before anyone. But I think it was probably too personal. And the music was just too far ahead of its time. On the other hand, I can't say, we don't know if Nick's music had gotten more exposure. I think that a song like One of These Things First on the Brighter Lighter album was really intended to be a single. I think that's why that he intended that song to be the single, because it's so accessible. That song is very easy to love and to enjoy. It's very much in the style of, say, a Tim Hardin song. I think that song could have done well if he had a band that would have helped him, I think, tour more easily. But there just wasn't the money to do that. And he wasn't the type of person, I think, who would have done that.
Right. Now, yeah, One of These Things First, I always cry when I listen to that one. It is so beautiful.
Oh, it's a beautiful lyric. I think one of his best. The simplicity, the focus, a magnificent melody and chord progression. Everything about that song is just perfect. And I think that if that song had gotten the kind of airplay that it takes to make a single happen, and he had been able to tour behind it, I think that song would have done well for him, and he probably would have had a much, much greater, he would have had the kind of record sales then that would have put him on the map that he's having now.
Right, it's interesting, nobody really did any covers through the years either.
No, he never did. I think that we all shared, many of us shared the same feeling about that, which was it was easier to write a song than to learn one.
Mm-hmm.
And coming from that folk background where we did cover a lot of, I mean, that was all you did was covers of traditional. And then finally, I mean, people just began writing their own songs that sounded like they were traditional. And from then on, I don't think we ever looked back.
Right.
Joe Boyd joked one night, and he said that my song was the only song Nick ever covered. But he didn't officially cover my song, so it doesn't count.
I'll accept it. I think it's wonderful that you're in there with him.
Oh, I do too. I'm so grateful that he did record it, that somebody found that tape and put it on the Time of No Reply CD, and that I was able to hear it. And it really, you know, started me looking back to those days once again and thinking about Nick's music, and that in turn led me into these kind of discoveries about his songwriting. People knew all along what a great guitar player he was. He's always been acknowledged as a great guitar player. But I don't think anyone really had noticed. No one was really writing about his songwriting. Mm-hmm. And that's what I saw. And Mojo Magazine was good enough to run an article that I wrote in 1998 about his songs, his songwriting. And I think from then on, then people began to realize what a unique genius he was. in every way, both as an instrumental player and as a songwriter. That's almost that's unheard of, to be a genius in both of those areas, to pioneer big changes in both, in two different areas. And he did that, and he did it so quietly that really no one noticed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's the amazing thing. Well, you know, in your on your website, you quote, funnily enough, you quote Robert Graves, the British poet. You say that the muse wields the power of life and death.
Yes.
And, you know, that seems to be the case here. And it's interesting that you quoted Robert Graves, because one of our other programmers is a wonderful, talented musician called Teresa Tudori, and she actually lived with Robert Graves on Mallorca for a number of years. They were friends with him and his family.
Oh, my goodness, my goodness. What a person to know. What a tremendously talented, eccentric, unusual, brilliant man. Yes, his book, The White Goddess, I know there's many mixed feelings about that book, but there are five chapters in it about muses, about people who inspire us to do things that lift us up beyond what we could do on our own, that make us greater than we are. And I'm fascinated by that. I see Nick pursuing a muse figure through many of his songs and relating to that figure all the way through all three albums. You know, on Five Leaves Left, the character, the muse, is obviously the princess character that you see in cello song. Mm. And in Brighter, Lighter, it's Hazy Jane, who is much more now earthy and has feet of clay on Brighter, Lighter. She's becoming more real. And then on the third album, on Pink Moon, all the way through, he's talking those songs he's kind of giving up on pursuing the muse. You can take the road that leads you to the stars. I can take the road that'll just see me through, you know, I can't get there until the final song, when that muse figure, that female muse figure, appears again. And now she is everywhere. She's the pantheistic mother goddess, all the world, all life, all air. It's that last song is so chilling. It's quite an amazing, if you trace that figure through from the first album to the last song on Pink Moon, you can follow him growing in relation to and changing in relation to his experience of this muse figure that inspires him and that he strives for. And I don't necessarily think that it's not one person, it may not even be a person, but I think often it is embodied in a person, and it can be embodied in many people, as I think it probably was for him. And but to see him project his creativity and his need to reach out and reconnect with split in himself, reaching out and trying to reunify himself all the way to the last song, and in the last song he does, is remarkable. I think that's quite a unique, to watch an artist do that in such a short period of time, over such a short period of work.
Yeah, quite an arc, yeah.
Yes.
And, well, other people took him as a muse. I mean, John Martin wrote Solid Air for him.
Oh, yes, and I think that's probably John's greatest song. As among many great performances and songs, Solid Air certainly stands out. And of course, Nick is inspiring people now to write songs. Many people cite him as an inspiration and a muse. And I think that Nick created a situation in which he created a persona. And I think he knew he was doing it on the albums, where he created this kind of poet in the darkness, you know, the poet who stands apart and watches others. And I wouldn't call him a rebel even though I think that's in there. I think he's too restrained and British to be a rebel, but if I may say that. But I think there's that the poetic outsider. Let's call it that, the poetic outsider. He created that, and I think he was doing it when I met him. He was playing that role in his dress, in the way he carried himself, in this the notion that he sort of appeared and stayed as long as he felt like and then disappeared from the crowd, and created a kind of a sense of mystique about himself that I do think he was aware of. And he put it, it's on the album, and I said one time in my, the article I wrote for Mojo, he created a kind of a trap. I think he wrote in his songs, a lot of his songs and his persona says, love me, love me, you know, embrace me, you know, and that's there. And then he died, and he left that trap wide open. One of his fans said one time, and I thought it was very observant of her, she said, you people who knew him, you were so lucky, you know, because to actually get to know him, and then you knew that he was gone. We come to him, we discover his music, we fall in love with it, only to find out that he's gone. There won't be any more music. And that's almost much more devastating for them to learn after they hear this wonderful voice, you know, and see the wonderful photographs, to find out that he's dead and there won't be any more music, yeah.
Ooh, it's giving me the chills.
Yeah, it was very moving.
Yeah,
when she said that. And there's much. I mean, Nick's all three albums are very much, have a very strong persona. At that age, at age 20 to 22, he knew what role, and I use the word role not in the sense that he was acting something that was untrue. It was the truth, but he was taking a piece of himself and I think exaggerating it a little bit in order to create that persona. But to do that at that young age, is to be that self-aware, is remarkable. And to, and the consistency of all three albums suggests to me that he was aware of what he was doing. The fact that he wanted to include certain things and not other songs. You know, I'll put this in, but I don't want that in. And Joe talks about having those discussions with Nick, you know, I want to put this song in, and Nick saying, no, we're not putting that song in.
Wow, he wanted a certain tone to it.
Pardon?
Yeah. He wanted a certain tone to, you know, certain...
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Yes, he did. I wanted to mention something. There's a wonderful book called Frozen Light. It's Frozen Light. It's all one word.
Okay.
And it's written by a man named Colin Betts. B-E-T-T-S. Colin was with us. He was in X with us at the same time. Nick and his friends famously took a trip in their car down to Morocco at one point that year. And when they were on their way back on the ferry coming back to Spain, they met Colin, who was on the ferry hitchhiking up from Marrakesh up to... He didn't know where. He was going, you know, anywhere that anybody was going. So Nick said, well, you know, we'll give you a ride in the car. And so he hopped in this tiny, these are like six guys now squeezed in this tiny little Ford Cortina with their guitars, of course. And off they went and back to X again. And then Colin stayed for the next two or three months. And he kept a journal. And I remember Colin, and I remember his journal, and every day he would write in his journal. It's the closest thing we have to a home movie of those times, because Colin wrote every day, every morning and every night. He wrote in his journal what he saw, what people said, who he met.
Wow.
So he said to me, he now is a Buddhist monk, and he lives in Scotland, and he said, I have a million words under the bed. And that, what he meant was, all my journals are here, and I keep them under the bed. And I've decided to pull them out and just turn them into books, because I should do something with them. So the first book is Frozen Light. And in it, there are two wonderful chapters about Nick, because Colin stayed. He slept on the floor over at the dormitory where all the guys were. Yeah.
I mean, you're still involved with Nick, I suppose. You've written liner notes and things like that for his music. It must be wonderful to still be connected.
It is. It is. And I think the thing I probably regret, I mean, I don't have too many regrets, but this is one. When I left the south of France and came back to California, I left the south of France. I went to London where I met John Martin and spent a couple months there. Then I came back to California. I never looked back. I think at that age, you don't stop to think, gee, I may never see that person again.
Right.
And life is so full and it's so exciting, and I went on and did so many more interesting things with music that I just never looked back. And then I think, I think hearing Been Smoking Too Long really triggered a lot of feelings, and I felt compelled, and I can't use any other word, and I've never felt anything else like this. I really felt compelled to go back and think this through and revisit the emotions and the things that happened at that time and try to figure out what happened. I don't know how to say it any differently.
Yeah.
Something happened, and I didn't know what it was,
right.
And I needed to go back and live that through again. And the only way to live that through again for me is to write songs about it. So I wrote an album called Waterfalls Down that is me going back. And I started those songs in 1997 or 96, I guess, and going back and writing it out.
Yeah.
I mean, I did a lot of crying, and I did a lot of to get that out. And I'm so fortunate to be a songwriter. And I say to people, you know, if you are an artist, if you are a poet, even it doesn't matter if you don't publish books. It doesn't matter. If you write, if you sing, if you paint, if you dance, you can save your life. There will be a time when that will save your life. And it saved mine. Writing that album absolutely saved my life. When you go back to something that's that, I think, dark and compelling, you have to do something with it in order to work it out. You can't stay there.
Right.
And so you work it out by writing about it or singing about it or dancing about it, whatever it is that you do. And then when that finally begins to work its way through, that's when I began to then look at the songs and appreciate him as an artist and not just as a person that I knew that I had to deal with.
Right.
And that has gone on ever since. It's been about 10 years. When I went after Birmingham, after I did the tribute concert, I went to visit Gabrielle Drake.
Oh, yeah.
And Gabrielle took me to the graveyard at the church.
Hmm.
And I went back to visit Nick's gravestone, which I hadn't done in 10 years. And I found that I felt this had come full circle and I had completed something. It doesn't mean it goes away. It just meant that I think emotionally I felt that I had completed something that started about a long time ago.
Indeed. Quite a journey. Well, thank you very much, Robin Frederick. What a wonderful insight into Nick Drake you've given us. It's just been fabulous.
Thank you.
Thank you for giving a call into Cal's Radio up here in Occidental.
If you're interested, you can find some articles about Nick that I wrote. You can find the Mojo article that I wrote on my website.
Yes, website.
At robinfrederick.com. That's RobinFrederick.com. And what you'll see when you go there is actually a lot of my songwriting information and that I do. I have a book on songwriting called Shortcuts to Hit Songwriting that really grew out of a lot of the things that I'm saying now, even though the title sounds, I think, more crass than the book is. it grew out of a lot of things that we're talking about. And but there, you'll find on the homepage, if you scroll down, you'll see articles about Nick Drake. And those were the first articles that I wrote 10 years ago when I first began to explore this. And it's always, always enriching for me to talk about Nick, to talk about his songwriting, to try to help people understand and appreciate even more about what he did with his art, because understanding it does not take away from the mystery of it. It only deepens it and deepens our appreciation.
Oh, that's a great thing to finish up on. Thank you very much, Robin.
My pleasure. My pleasure, Arnold.
And I'll run off with him playing They're Leaving Me Behind.
Oh, good. That's great.
Okay.
Great.
Thanks.
Good night.
Thanks so much, Robin.
Oh, you're welcome. Good night.
Good night. Leaving Me Behind by Nick Drake. And I want to say thank you so much, Robin Frederick, for giving us a wonderful insight into the musical genius of Nick Drake. This is Arnaldo, your host of Tommy's Holiday Camp here on Cowes Radio 107.3 in delectable downtown Occidental. in the West County of Sonoma. Phone number in the studio, 707-874-1073. And as promised, I will be playing my interview with Richard Thompson, who will be appearing at the Cape Wolf Festival this Sunday, headlining it in about 3 minutes after, guess what, a Richard Thompson song, I Can't Wake Up to Save My Life.